Okay, right, good evening all. Welcome to the New York Federal Reserve Building in London School of Economics. And particularly, I should say, I'm Tony Travers from the Government Department here at the LSE, and we're very delighted here to be offering an opportunity to hear from one of the authors of this book. This is, in a sense, one of a number of launch events, I think it's fair to say. The book's called Revolt on the Right, Explaining Support for the Radical Right in Britain, and it's by Robert Ford, who's standing here, and Matthew Goodwin, and it has a very fetching picture of Nigel Farage, not only holding a beer, but also with a cigarette in his between his fingers, so it's a well-chosen photograph. Rob works at the University of Manchester. He's at the Institute for Social Change as the Halsworth Research Fellow and has previously had a number of roles, mostly at the University of Oxford, and has been employed by the BBC as a consultant sophologist for the coverage of general European devolved and local elections. Well, I'd say, by way of, as I was saying to Rob when I arrived, it's hard to think of an academic book that's had more impact as soon as it's been published. Brilliant piece of timing, and also a very, in my view, convincing analysis. But still, I'm preempting the lecture. Rob.
Thank you very much, Tony. Timing is everything. We did expect you to rise, as they are at the moment, perhaps not as far or as fast as they've gone. Regarding the photo, Nigel Farage himself is less of a fan because he says it makes he's about the colour of Robert Kilroy silk in that photo, which is not a comparison that he likes.
Kilroy's birthday.
Is it Kilroy's birthday today? Well, that will be some party, I imagine. I've actually just come direct from the BBC's relocated election centre in Elstree, where we've been running rehearsals, and judging from the data they were using in the rehearsals, they are expecting UKIP to do very well this week. Right, so to start off, why did we write this book? Why am I here discussing this book? Well, this is a graph produced by another project I'm involved with in terms of aggregating all Westminster polling data, and I think it pretty much tells a clear story all by itself. The data here starts just when the coalition begins in 2010, when UKIP had about 3% of the vote on average in polling. Last summer, you'll see the first peak when they averaged about 15%. Some polls put them as high as 20 or 22. They then sort of faded away a little bit in the autumn, and then since the beginning of this year, they've kept coming back. In fact, the latest estimate we ran, which I didn't have time to add to this graph, puts them on 14.4%, close to their previous peak. And they will be going higher in the next couple of months, I assure you. If we take a longer-term view, this is directly from the data we used in the book, you can see that starting with the emergence of the coalition, UKIP have been rising steeply and pretty much inexorably in the polling. We now have a situation where up to one in six voters is regularly expressing a preference for UKIP, and this is the first new party, grassroots party, to achieve that level of support since Labour broke through in the 1920s. I don't count the SDP in that because the SDP were in many ways a split at the top rather than a movement that emerged from the bottom. UKIP are the most successful grassroots party that we've seen in post-war British politics, bar none. So this is why we wanted to try and figure out what's going on with them. A second reason we really wanted to try and figure out what's going on with UKIP is that we felt that the popular understanding of UKIP was deficient in a number of ways. This cartoon rather illustrates what the average journalist, the average sort of reader of politics, follower of politics, has tended to think UKIP is all about. But essentially what it is a sort of movement of disgruntled right-wing conservatives who have sort of defected over to this rebel movement on the basis of discontent with UKIP. And even from very early on, when we were analysing UKIP as part of our work on the far right, we could see that picture was really misleading in several respects. And one of the aims with the book was to try and actually present a much more detailed and sort of correct picture to dispel this stereotype of a bunch of kind of barber jacket wearing, ruddy faced colonels in golf clubs out in the shires, which is the average sort of UKIP stereotype that you see bandied about. So the key questions that we wanted to investigate with regards UKIP's revolt were, firstly, who are this party? Who's actually backing it? Is it a movement of middle-class conservative discontents, or is it more like the kind of radical right movements that have been emerging on the continent of Europe for 20 or 30 years now, the Nordic People's Parties, the French Front National, the Wilders Party, the Freedom Party in Austria, and so on. These are all parties that tend to have a very similar electorate with a very similar set of concerns. Older blue-collar voters who are discontented about their sort of feeling of a lack of representation in the system, about cultural change, and about immigration. So the common stereotype is that UKIP is different to that. It's a sort of EU protest movement. But we had an inkling that perhaps they had quite a lot in common with these parties over the channel. We also wanted to look at what motivates the average UKIP voter. Is this all about the EU? Is it about a certain section of the British electorate deciding enough is enough with Europe, integration has gone too far, and they really want to put pressure on the political system to row back, to get out of the EU, or at the very least to reform it fundamentally? Or is this actually about a broader set of domestically focused issues? Immigration, which has been at the top of the political agenda since well before UKIP emerged. Social change more generally. And what we've also seen many examples of, this growing feeling that the political system no longer represents or is accountable to the voters. This kind of populist politics of resentment. And the third question we were interested in is, why now? Why this sudden uptick in support? You see an awful lot of analysis of UKIP that places them specifically within the context of this coalition period of government. Austerity, the disappearance of the Lib Dems as a kind of outlet for discontent with governing parties. Is this actually just a 2010 to 2015 story, or has what UKIP done, have they mobilised back into politics longer standing divisions within the population? So those are the questions I'm going to talk to you about today. I'm also going to talk a little bit at the end about UKIP's prospects this week, which seems appropriate and timely, and also about UKIP's prospects next year. Everyone within UKIP that we've talked to regards next May as make or break for them. Nigel Farage has said he will resign if they don't get any seats. He means it. The party is basically like a gambler in Monaco staking all of their chips on May 7th next year. They have to get into Westminster or they're bust. They know that. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the challenges that they face in doing that and what their prospects might be. So, first of all, what data are we using to investigate this new party? Well, it's basically three sets of data. To investigate the long-term story of social change, which we think puts UKIP into sort of political context, we make use of the now 50-year run of data that you can get from the British Election Studies and the 30-odd year run of data from the British Social Attitudes Survey. That enables us to tell a very broad but broad sweep story about social demographic change, which we think is an important part of the UKIP story. And then to analyse what's happened in the past decade with UKIP, we have data from another British election study data collection effort called the Continuous Monitoring Study. The British election study team, since 2004, have surveyed 1,000 people a month, every month, all the way through to the present day. You aggregate all of those monthly samples together, you get about 125,000 interviews, of which about 5,600 are UKIP supporters. That enables us to build a much more comprehensive picture of what's driving the average UKIP supporter, because of course until a couple of years ago they were quite a small party in terms of popular support. It also enables us to look at how this support has changed over time. Third source of data is we really wanted to get the inside story on the party as well. There's not just a demand side story, there's an important supply side story to tell here as well. So we've been out and interviewed all of the senior figures that we could get hold of that would speak to us in the party, including four of the current or former leaders, many of the most senior activists within the party, and sort of more junior activists as well, and funders of the party. So we've built a picture of how UKIP viewed all this from within. How did they change? How did they evolve? How do they perceive the challenges that they face? So, the first part I want to talk about is the social roots of all of this. I did my training in Oxford as a political sociologist. I worked with people like Anthony Heath and David Butler, so I'm a big believer in the sort of grand sweep social structure type story of how parties emerge. You don't have 15% of an electorate coming over to a party unless there was something there that led to them having that kind of appeal. That kind of level of success suggests some sort of compelling story of social division, and that's what I went looking for in this data. And the story that we tell in the book is a story about what we call the left behind electorate. Essentially, what we believe has happened is that over the past 25 years or so, we've moved from a society where to win an electoral majority at Westminster, you had to win a large section of the working class vote, to a situation where to win a majority at Westminster, the focus was actually on middle class centrist voters. If you look at some of the key, I mean, these are just a selection of indicators. I could have used many others. Working class here is defined using the sort of Goldthorpe-Heath schema. You go back to the 1960s, and you're looking at about half of the electorate doing blue-collar occupations, blue-collar jobs. By the time you get up to the 2000s, that's fallen to less than 3 in 10. If you look at the proportion of trade union members, it goes from 40% to under 20%. And the proportion of voters with no qualifications who leave school at 16, this is particularly critical because education is a big part of the UKIP story, that goes from a majority of the electorate to around 20% of the electorate in the most recent data. So there is a fundamental shift here from a situation where the Conservatives or Labour had to focus on what are the key concerns of working class voters if they were to achieve an electoral majority, to the situation we have right now, where with every single passing electoral cycle, the professional middle classes, the university degree holders, become more and more central to the political story. And they do in two ways. Firstly, in terms of electorates. The 2010 election was the first election in which Labour, the Conservatives and the Liberal Democrats received more than 50% of their support from the middle class. Labour too, all three of the parties received the majority of their support from the middle class. It never happened before. That share will carry on going up because of economic transformations. And that just amplifies the political incentive to focus on those middle class voters and on their concerns. And indeed, if you look at the political story, what do you see? You see Labour making that move to the centre and focusing on middle-class swing voters in the mid-1990s, and then you see the Conservatives following, particularly on social issues, with the election of Cameron. Both parties think this is an electorate that's becoming more educated, more university-focused, more diverse. We have to move in that direction. And of course, the other factor that moves them in that direction is, if you look at the activist base of all three of these parties, they are now very heavily dominated by exactly these groups, professional, middle-class, university degree holders. The share of Labour activists who are coming from the traditional blue-collar union professions has fallen very sharply. The share of Labour MPs who have come from traditional blue-collar occupations has gone from nearly 100 in 1979 to about 16 or 17, I think it is, in the most recent parliament. And this matters because the interests of working-class voters and values of working-class voters are not the same as the interests and values of middle-class voters. And the divide is largest on the very issues that you find UKIP mobilising support on. So this chart shows you the proportion of voters who support leaving the EU entirely from the British Social Attitudes Survey. And you'll see that the voters who left school without a single exam certificate to their name, more than half of them by the end of this period were supporting leaving the EU entirely. Working class voters, it goes up to about 40%. That is more than twice the level of support for that option amongst the middle class professional groups. So there's a very big divide there. The idea of leaving Europe is an extremely popular one amongst blue-collar voters, but has very little support amongst middle-class voters. There is also a generational story to tell here. It's particularly older working-class voters who support this kind of thing. The generations who grew up in particular before Britain joined the EU in the 1970s, the people born in the 1930s and 40s and 40s and 50s, they tend to have much higher levels of support for leaving than the cohorts who come after. In particular, if you look at the cohort born after 1975, you see that the support's like about 15 or 16%, so well under half the level that you would see amongst their grandparents. Nor is it just Europe. The big issue that we've been seeing an awful lot of debate about in the past few weeks is immigration and the views of UKIP activists and the views of the UKIP Labour on immigration. And here perhaps we see this value divide most starkly of all. This is from an item that I'm very fond of because I think it gives a particularly accurate sort of barometer of public opinion. On the YouGov surveys, there's a question where it asks the respondents, what do you think is the most important issues facing the country right now? And then just gives them a blank text box and invites them to fill in by themselves what they want, whatever they want, unprompted. You get some very interesting little essays appearing in there sometimes from some of the respondents. And this just takes all the voters who've entered in immigration as one of the things that they put in as the top of their head concerns that they're worried about. And back in the boom years, you'll see immigration was sort of being listed by about one third of working class voters as a primary concern, more than double the level of concern we see amongst middle class voters. Then we see everybody refocus on the economy following the crash. So 2008, 2009, we see these concerns drift down the agenda. The big concern is the financial crisis, the deficit, and so on and so forth. But look what's happening as the recovery is taking hold. The working class's minds are turning back to immigration. This gap is now larger than it is at any point previously in our data, while middle class voters do not regard immigration as the primary concern. They never have, but now, even more so, these voters are living in different worlds. These working class, low education, older voters are really deeply anxious about immigration. This is really the thing that they worry about most intensely. It's what they consider the top of the political agenda. Whereas the middle class groups who dominate our political parties in the mainstream, who dominate our media, who dominate the commentariat that frames these issues, do not see immigration as being a big issue. And they, as we have seen in recent weeks, have rather a lot of scepticism about the motives of those who do see this as a big issue. Now, think of it from the perspective of these working class voters. When they see this party raise the issue that's top of their agenda, they repeatedly see people who don't think like them, who don't share their values, whacking this party back down again, calling it racist, calling it intolerant, calling it unacceptable debate. What they see is an effort to once again push their concerns off the political agenda. And that matters because these voters have always believed that the political agenda is not about their concerns. And they believe this more now than they have at any point in the past. So the share of these voters who say, I have no say in politics, who strongly agree with that statement, is around 4 in 10. Whereas for the middle class, it's about 15%. So you've got a huge bunch of voters who instinctively believe that the political class doesn't want to talk about what they're concerned about. And you reinforce that message. It's hard to see how that actually successfully combats something like UKIP. It in fact plays in to the dynamic that something like UKIP is feeding off. So, the demand was there. It's been there for years because we've seen structural change that has made these voters less essential for the mainstream parties to appeal to. And we've seen attitudinal divergence such that their agenda is now very different to the agenda of the middle-class voters that parties do appeal to, and we have seen this deep-seated, intense disaffection amongst this group, which means that they don't trust the mainstream political parties to deliver or to articulate and respond to the concerns that they have. So the message is, the UKIP revolt was a long time coming. The divisions in society that UKIP have mobilised into politics were there for a long time before. UKIP has just been the first party to actually articulate them. So in our view, this is not a 2010 to 15 story. This is a story whose roots go back into the early 1990s, perhaps even further. So now I'm going to talk about who exactly it is that UKIP wins its support from. And the first point I would make is UKIP's support is more demographically well-defined than the support of any other political party in the system today. All of these bars here show essentially predictor coefficients from a regression model, with all the other things controlled for. And UKIP are the most working-class party, and class is a stronger predictor of their support than for any other party. They're the most low-education party, and education is a stronger predictor of their support. They are more male. They are very much a sort of grey-haired party, particularly the over 65s, and they are very, very white. I think we have about 4 non-white UKIP supporters in our entire sample of 6,000 or so. So this is a very clearly drawn demographic. Older, white working-class men who left school with no qualifications. That is your modal UKIP supporter. What concerns them? Well, it won't surprise anybody to learn that they are a very, very Eurosceptic bunch. 99% of UKIP voters in our sample disapprove of Britain's membership of the EU. But it is not just about the EU. There are an awful lot of Eurosceptics who don't back UKIP. We regard Europe as being a necessary but not sufficient condition. One way of thinking of it is it's like a foot in the door. UKIP can get their foot in the door with voters by saying, we don't like Europe, you don't like Europe. But then that's not enough to make the sale. To make the sale, they need to also find some appeal on domestic issues. And the two that we found to be most significant are populist dissatisfaction with the state of democracy and anxiety about immigration. Both of those have a very strong relationship as issues with UKIP support. So voters who are Eurosceptic and populist, or Eurosceptic and anti-immigration, or even better, all three, those are the voters who go over to UKIP, not just the ones who are Eurosceptic alone. We also had a look at parties' performance ratings. The data we had included performance ratings on a whole range of issues, I think about 6 or 7. And what emerged very clearly is that there were 2 issues and 2 issues alone that seemed to predict UKIP support. One, unsurprisingly, is immigration. The second one, quite interestingly, was the financial crisis. UKIP voters tend to be voters who think both of the mainstream parties have done a terrible job at managing the financial crisis. And in both cases, these bars basically show the separate impact, but when you actually model it statistically, what comes out is it's the voters who reject both. The voters who say both have failed that emerge as the ones who back UKIP. These other issues, the sort of bread and butter issues of social services, crime, terrorism and so on, no effect on UKIP support at all. This is an agenda that's about immigration, but it's also about, we've had this huge crash, you've screwed it up, you've not managed it well. So there is this economic element to it as well.
Just to check, I've understood that.
Yeah.
That one means that the people who vote UKIP, they're most likely to think the Labour Party and the Conservative Party are doing badly on that issue, is that right?
Yes.
So here they think the Labour Party is doing well on the health service, the same people.
Yes, yeah, actually it's not statistically significant, but voters who think that Labour are doing well on the NHS are much less likely to go to UKIP, but it's not significant. It's primarily about that left-hand side right there. We also looked at the leaders. You may have seen in much recent press that we live in an unusual era and that much of the public hate both the current political parties' leaders. It seems to be a race of 2 one-legged men. UKIP voters, though, in particular, seem to particularly dislike the options on the table in terms of leadership. And these effects, incidentally, are controlling for other effects. And again, it's a case of rejecting both. But in this case, it's new. Before Ed Miliband became the Labour leader in 2000, and I think at the end of 2010, wasn't it? You saw basically that Conservative Party leadership was much more important. The UKIP voters were ones who really disliked the current Conservative leader, which would fit with the story of them being disgruntled right-wingers to some extent. However, since 2011, and particularly in the last couple of years as UKIP has surged, it's again a story of the roughly one-third of the electorate who say that Ed Miliband's terrible, but also say David Cameron's terrible. that both are failing. Now, where's the support coming from politically? Here, we've had some interesting debates with people in the media, because we have often said that UKIP poses in particular a challenge for Labour because of the social mix of the people who back them. But people will say to us, ah, but their support comes primarily from people who backed the Conservatives in 2010. This is a split on the right. And if you look at our data and you look at 2010 vote recollections, they have a point. 50 to 60% of the UKIP voters in our sample since 2010 say, yes, we voted for the Conservative Party in 2010. So in that sense, there is a split on the right. However, 2010 was the lowest share of the vote that Labour had received in any election bar 1983 in the whole post-war period. It was a really low ebb for Labour, and in particular, we also know that Labour lost votes particularly heavily from working class voters, particularly private sector working class voters. So you could say it's not a particularly fair baseline, because the Conservatives had won over a lot of voters who might not be, in other respects, natural Conservative voters. Those voters might have headed to the exit pretty much regardless of whether UKIP was there or not. And indeed, that's what we see. The first thing that we see is there's a strong correlation between Labour's rebound since their low ebb, which we actually use 2009 as the baseline because they did recover somewhat before the election in 2010. They had the lowest ebb for Labour, and then look at how they are now, 4 or 5 years later. The big rebounds have come with groups where UKIP are very weak, with university graduates, with women, with under 35, with ethnic minorities. You're seeing Labour post double-digit gains in their share relative to their low ebb. And you're seeing UKIP much, much weaker. Then you look at the groups where UKIP have surged and Labour haven't advanced at all. So Labour have made a gain of 4% with the working class. They've made a gain of 3% with those who left school at 16, 2% with men. UKIP are the ones here posting the double-digit gains. So the Conservatives are leaking in two directions. Middle class, young, university graduates are leaking over to Labour. Working class, older voters, pensioners, white voters are leaking over to UKIP. If UKIP weren't there, would these voters, older working class voters who deeply dislike Cameron, who believe he's failed on immigration, who have suffered as a result of the austerity policies, would they still be in the Conservative coalition? Now that is obviously a hypothetical, we'll never know. There's a lot of reasons to think that they wouldn't be. And in particular, if we zero in on one group, we can see this effect in action. White working class pensioners. This is UKIP's strongest demographic, and it's a big chunk of the electorate because, of course, the old vote more. And if you take 2005, Tony Blair's last re-election, 45% of that group were voting for Labour. By 2009, that dropped to 38%, and then by 2013, it drops again to 26%. The Conservatives don't lose amongst this group, this core UKIP group. If this is a divide on the right, why is that number not changing? Why is it instead this bar on the left that we see declining as UKIP surge up from 3% to 28%? UKIP are now getting more voters amongst this group than Labour are. So this is why we think this is not necessarily just a story of a divide on the right, but a divide on the left. And more recently, one weakness of the data we use is it didn't contain anything on ideological values. And we argued that this was potentially an old Labour electorate. These were the kind of voters who would have been firmly behind the Labour of Neil Kinnock and John Smith and so forth, but were never really sold on the new Labour project, the middle-class swing voter Labour project. But we hadn't got any ideological attitudes data to really back that intuition up. But the British Election Study last month released new data on the ideological leanings of voters, which gave us for the first time a really decent chunk of UKIP voters that we could look at. Well, what are their ideological leanings? And there were five questions in that survey that are questions that have been used since the 1970s to measure that sort of fundamental left-right divide over the role of the state, the rights of the workers, the redistribution of income. It's a very, very strong predictor of left-right ideological values, well-validated, used in many countries. And what happens when you run those attitudes on UKIP voters? You find they are closer to Labour than the Conservatives. Indeed, they are closer to Labour than the Liberal Democrats. The average support for left-wing arguments on these five items is 70%. This is indeed an old left electorate. These are economic left-right questions. If you look at social left-right questions, it's a very different story, of course. But on economics, on the arguments about zero-hours contracts, about minimum wages, about redistribution of money, about dealing with the banks, UKIP voters are instinctively in Labour's camp. And so it's a big problem for Labour that 10 to 15% of the electorate who instinctively favour the economic agenda that's currently being promoted by the Labour Party leader as the major part of their electoral pitch for 2015 are not backing him, but are backing a Thatcherite banker from the city who's talking to them about immigration. Now, the final issue I want to move on to talking about, having looked at social structure, having looked at attitudes, is, well, what's going to happen next year? Can UKIP really break through? And the first point to make is to tell a little bit of a cautionary tale from history. These bars show you the situation in three elections in the 1980s and early 1990s. They tell the story of the failure of Britain's previous insurgency to break through. Here are the votes in 1983. Here's Labour on 27, and here's the Social Democrats on 25, 2 percentage points apart. But in seats terms, that 2 percentage points was a chasm. They had a handful of seats, the Social Democrats. Only about 3.5% of the total in the House of Commons. And so, despite winning the support of a quarter of the electorate, they had no influence at all in the subsequent House of Commons. It's seats or nothing in our system if you want to realign it. In 1987, they won slightly less in terms of votes and still no seats. And then by 1992, people have started to drop away from supporting them. What follows in the 1990s is the Ashdown movement to basically focus very clearly on local constituencies, build up seat by seat, local authority by local authority, to the current situation where they finally find themselves as the very junior partner in a coalition. But they thought in 1983 that they could break through nationwide, and it fell horribly flat. Now, this cautionary tale is important because it's a cautionary tale that every UKIP leader, every UKIP activist will tell you. They are very familiar with the history of the Social Democrats and the history of the Liberal Democrats, and their focus right now is on doing what Ashdown did in the 1990s rather than trying to do what the SDP Gang of Four did in 1983. They know that the nationwide top-down campaign is doomed to fail. So their whole focus is on how can we win from the bottom up. And this is difficult for them. The first problem that they face is that every time we've had a European Parliament election in the past 15 years, UKIP have picked up a lot of new recruits. But then they've immediately lost them again. So in the last one in 2009, UKIP support tripled in our data from under 2% to over 6%. And then in the following 6 months, it went all the way back again. All those new voters disappeared. Right now, we have polling showing UKIP on 28, 30%. Obviously, that's on a low turnout election, but even if you allow for that, you're talking 22, 23, 24% of a general election electorate, potentially. And we will see them surge in Westminster polling for sure. This is Westminster polling right here. The coverage they get far exceeds what they get at other times, and that converts into extra votes, but not for long. One of their challenges is how do we keep these voters on board during the period when we are receiving perhaps less attention, when the issue agenda is less favourable to us. Many of these voters may be voters who aren't natural UKIP voters as well, that are sort of easier to pull back to the mainstream parties. But they need some of these voters if they're going to win constituencies. The second big problem that they face is that UKIP have completely failed in all of their previous general elections to build any local bases of support. There was only one seat in the whole country where they got more than 15% last time, and that's the Speaker's seat, where they ran against the Speaker, and despite the fact that none of the three main parties stood against the Speaker by convention, they still came third to a local Conservative discontent. So they didn't even manage to come second in a seat where they didn't have any local competition. The rest of the seats, their performance clusters incredibly narrowly. And this is a huge problem in the first-past-the-post system. You can pick up millions of votes, but if they're distributed like this, you have no chance of getting any seats. And this is why they have focused on by-elections and local elections. Here's how UKIP have advanced in the by-elections that we've had so far in this parliament. I'm just picking the highlights, the ones where they did really well. They first really started on a sort of by-election strategy in Oldham East, the Phil Willis seat, which was vacated because of a conviction for sort of electoral misdemeanors. And they only advanced 2% on that occasion, so it wasn't great. But then a few months later, they got another shot in Barnsley, another MP misdemeanors. They got up 7.5%. Fast forward to November of that year, to November of the following year, Corby, where Louise Mensch vacated the seat, the first Labour gain of the Parliament, and UKIP go from 0 to 14%. Then in Rotherham, where they benefited from a local scandal concerning the council basically wanting to take away foster children because their parents supported UKIP, kind of a useful story for the party, they go up 16 percentage points. And they come in second, which is really critical, because they know how the Lib Dems use second places in general elections. You'll get those leaflets with the little horses, and it'll say, only UKIP can win here, and all the other parties way behind. You have to have those second places to do those kind of leaflets, though. And Rotherham and Corby, Rotherham and Barnsley were the first ones where they did that. Then Middlesbrough, they get another second. And then, of course, Eastleigh, Chris Hume. They pick a very effective local candidate, they run a very intensive campaign, and they come within 3 percentage points of taking the seat. They go past the Conservatives into second place. So here's a seat where they can say to the local Conservatives, if you want to reject the Liberal Democrats that you don't like very much now, you need to vote for us. We are the local opposition, not your party. You need to vote tactically for us, you need to get us over the top. And then in South Shields, in that May, they did the same in a rock-solid Labour seat. Nearly a quarter of the vote in a seat that's never done anything but vote Labour. So what we're seeing here is the accumulation of seats where you can make the arguments to the local electorate, we are the local opposition. This is how you break through in a first-past-the-post system. It's not enough to be polling nationally at 10 to 15%. You have to have places where you can say, we are viable, we are legitimate, we are the party who can compete against the current incumbent. And local elections have been the other area where they've been focusing very intensely with the same goal in mind. What I'm showing you here is how they've increased the number of candidates they've put up compared to the previous cycle, all through this current election cycle. They doubled their numbers in 2010, they tripled their numbers in 2011, and they tripled their numbers in 2013. And look at what happens to the votes that they win. They're going up from less than 100,000. They never used to take local elections very seriously. They regarded it as boring and nothing to do with their core issue of Europe. Now they, you know, if you're in an area where you keep campaigning, you'll know it. You'll get the leaflets, you'll have the people knocking on your doors with the rosettes and everything. Just like the Liberal Democrats back in the 1990s. And in 2013, they finally achieved that goal of getting over that hump under first past the post, that sort of 20, 25, 26% hump where you actually start getting swathes of local wards falling your way. You got 24% of the vote, over a million voters, and they took 147 local council seats. That gives them a whole range of councils where they can go into the general election saying, we are part of the local furniture. We are, in some cases, the local opposition. We are the party who can compete against the incumbents here in this area. We are your local opposition. So that is new. That has never happened for UKIP before. It never happened for the BNP in anywhere near the same extent as it's happened for UKIP, although UKIP learned from the BNP on this as well as from the Liberal Democrats. So where does that leave us? Where might UKIP find success? Well, in the book we looked at a whole range of factors, because it's not enough for them to have a demographically favourable area. They need to have an area that's politically favourable as well. A relatively low share of the vote for the incumbent, and preferably also some local election strength, some candidates, some local councillors elected and so on. We think that the best seat combining these factors is Austin Mitchell's former seat of Great Grimsby. We have a very large old, white working class pensioner population. You have a seat that's now vacant, that hasn't been competitive for 30 or 35 years, and guess who UKIP have put up as their candidate in that seat? The woman who came within 300 votes of beating Austin Mitchell last time when she stood as a Conservative. She's now a UKIP candidate. She's known to the local population, very well known. She was a Conservative councillor for years. You see, they've learned what sort of candidate to put up. A woman helps them appeal to the female vote where they struggle. Someone with years of experience on the local council and someone who previously stood as a Conservative candidate and came very close. A credible local challenger. And they will find other seats, possibly from this, possibly from elsewhere, where they'll do the same. Find strong, credible local candidates with local roots, local experience, faces who've been part of the furniture. They have learned how to do first-past-the-post politics, or they believe they have. Now, who faces a threat from all of this? Well, Labour, in short. In terms of where are the seats where UKIP voters concentrate, where are the seats that are most demographically favourable to UKIP, all the way down the line, from the top 20 to the 61 to 80, it's nearly all Labour-held seats. And this is despite the fact, of course, that the number of Labour-held seats available is much lower right now than it has been in the past. The kind of seats where UKIP have the most potential voters, old white working class voters, those are traditional Labour seats. So, to sum up, I think I'm on time.
You are.
I've got to say a bit about the European Parliament, though. Firstly, UKIP are not a flash in the pan. What they have brought into politics is a set of resentments and conflicts and pressures that have been there for decades and which have been in politics in many other European countries with less challenging electoral systems for decades. What we're seeing now in Britain in the 2010s, the French saw in the 1980s, the Danish saw in the 1990s, the Norwegians saw in the 1990s, the Swiss saw in the 1990s. This is not new and it's not different. It's one of the broad problems and challenges that all West European political party systems are going to have to face over the coming decades. There is a section of the electorate that feels disconnected from the current system, that feels that social change is threatening things that they value, and feels that none of the mainstream political parties articulate or respond to the concerns that they have. UKIP is just the latest in a long line of examples of that challenge. And in many respects, they are a typical one. The issues they mobilise, the voters they mobilise, they look like a typical member of the radical right party family in these respects. But what is different about UKIP is that they do come from an unusual tradition. You don't find many radical right parties in Europe that started as anti-EU protest parties. That's an unusual place to come from in politics. You don't have many that have just come across, splintered across from the centre right. There are some. And it's an important political tradition because it gives UKIP what one of my colleagues and co-authors calls a reputational shield. We have seen in the past few weeks a great deal of effort to paint UKIP as essentially a racist movement. That effort has been nowhere near as successful as it has been in the past for parties like the BNP or the NF here, or for the NF in France before Marine Le Pen took over. That is because it's quite easy for UKIP to point to its history, to point to its constitution, to point to its membership, to point to its ideology and say, this is not a racist party. The charge is overmade. We are basically a legitimate part of the political system and you don't want to talk about the issues we want to talk about. But we are not racist, we are not fascist, we are not anti-democratic. They are not, in short, Golden Dawn. They are not Jobbik. They are not the BNP. And that matters, because the average voter perceives that, and it means that UKIP can progress further than some of these more extreme parties would be able to, because the charge of racism matters in modern politics. You get pinned with it, it's very hard to really progress into the mainstream. Okay, so prospects for next week. Matt and I think that there's a very good chance that UKIP will win outright this week. Every European Parliament election we've seen UKIP benefit from a number of factors specific to those kinds of elections. You get what we call strategic defectors. These are voters who've got no intention of ever voting UKIP in a general election, but who like sending a message to the Westminster elites about their views on Europe. So they back UKIP instrumentally, and they boost UKIP's voting allegiance in this situation. It is also what we would call a home fixture. This is an election about the EU. So if you are an anti-EU party, this is on your core issue straight away. And now that immigration is very much a phenomenon that's tied up in the average voter's mind with the EU, it's a home fixture in two ways. And thirdly, the second order election dynamics that we always see in these contests where, you know, it's an opportunity to give the governing parties a good kicking, that helps UKIP, particularly now that they are the dominant anti-government party available. Proportional representation also greatly helps them because it gets rid of this problem of, you know, votes to seats. People can vote for them knowing that they'll be converted into seats. But for the party next year, the local elections are more significant. This is their last chance to add to that list of councillors, to add to that list of strong local election results that they can then take with them and print out on all the leaflets a year from now. They need to find areas where they can make a pitch to the voters that they are a locally legitimate, a locally strong party. At the moment, the even spread in UKIP support is a big problem for them. So for them, coming first in the European Parliament would be very nice in terms of the national coverage, but coming first in a set of wards in Lincoln or Sheffield or Manchester would be far better, far more important in terms of winning next year. But, one last thought, there seems to be a difference so far in the way the polling has run in 2013 compared to 2009. In 2009, UKIP surged in the very last 2 weeks, partly because of the expenses scam, and both the mainstream parties slumped. So far, in the polling we've seen this time, all three parties' shares are very, very stable. Does this mean that UKIP won't necessarily pick up as much support as they did previously? Is the situation a little bit more fixed than it was before? I don't know. It does look pretty tight between UKIP and Labour at the top, but I suspect some of these polls are overstating the share of voters who will actually vote. They tend to be saying 40-45%. That's a long way above what we normally get in European Parliament election. Okay, so that is all from me in terms of presentation, so I will welcome your questions.
Okay, thank you very much.
I'll put that back up.
Now, there's a roving microphone which can start to roam. I might just collect your thoughts as one at the back there. I mean, presumably there is an underlying issue for which this is a sort of silhouette, that is that the Labour plus Conservative vote, up till recently, and possibly now the Labour plus the Conservative plus the Liberal Democrat vote, is itself in long, long-term decline. So it begs the question of whether an incumbent party can at some time overhaul the unpopular of the two remaining main parties at some point. I mean, that's the issue, isn't it? Whether in the first pass of the post-voting system, whether an incumbent party, might be UKIP, might not be, could at one point overtake, you know, in a general election, one of the long-term declining either Conservative or Labour party. That's the underlying question here, because you've got, in the end, to get an incumbent party, you'd have to go into a general election with, I make it up, 28% of the vote, when the trailing Conservative or Labour Party was only on, and make it up, 23%. I mean, that's the way it would have to happen, isn't it? You've got to build for that. Well, the Labour in 2020 looks more likely than the Conservatives this time, if you see what I mean. Is that right?
That's right. Well, I mean, I think UKIP view their ultimate goals in one of two possible ways. One way it could go is the way that you're talking about, and there the model they have in mind is the Reform Party in Canada. Mm-hmm. The idea being that you overhaul one of the existing incumbents and basically become one of the new two-party incumbents under a first-past post, and you become the opposition and so on. The other way it can go is that you achieve a sufficiently large share of the vote that you force one of the incumbents to fundamentally reform himself. Farage likes to say he wants to do to the Conservative Party what the SDP did to the Labour Party. His argument being that the SDP never got to that position of overhauling an incumbent, but when you look at the Labour Party of the mid-1990s, it was pretty much what the SDP were asking for. And he thinks that if you get UKIP getting 20-25% of the vote and a few dozen seats, it'll force the Conservatives in the direction that he wants it to go.
Okay, very good question. And then here.
Thanks for the very illuminating talk. I'd like to ask you to what extent you think UKIP runs what I would refer to as Steve Jobs or Richard Branson risk, in the sense that its stock price is very linked to one man. Nigel Farage fell out of the sky at the last general election, was very badly injured. If anything were to happen to him, who's going to pick up the reins?
Shall I take them one at a
time?
It's
a
very good question. I think Farage's pivotal role in UKIP is often a little bit misunderstood. I don't think he's pivotal on the demand side, in that I don't think that much of their rise is to do with his personal popularity, but he is crucial on the supply side. He's crucial in terms of making the party legitimate and appealing to the mainstream media. He's the most regular appearer on Question Time. And he's also absolutely crucial because of UKIP, like many radical right parties, has a certain Monty Python tendency to fragmentation and petty conflict. Farage is very effective at keeping the party relatively united, relatively on message, relatively... And I mean, all these things are relative. We've seen in recent weeks this is not necessarily a particularly disciplined party, but by the standards of UKIP past, it really is. And were he to suffer another sort of health crisis, it's not yet clear that anybody in the second tier in UKIP could achieve that. And it's quite possible that a lot of the sort of tensions and conflicts within the party might break out into the open, and you'd see it sort of engaging in another bout of internal conflict. UKIP has nearly torn itself apart, I think, four times in the past 12 years. So it's very sort of fissile, and Farage is very crucial to stabilising that.
A fundamental point about the trends in post-war British political history. The point I'm saying is in the early 70s, of course, Enoch Powell, of course, was making his name, obviously, with his opposition to immigration, and, of course, his opposition to the common market. And it's just fascinating, we are 16 years after his death, and here we have this party which is basically representing his views, and it's just a fascinating insight as to the impact. You think of fundamental impacts and trends. Somebody who was just a cabinet minister for a year. That's what Enoch Powell was in formal terms, and yet he seems to be one of the most significant politicians. And here we are. This man was born in 1912, and here we are in the early 20th century, the 21st century, discussing all these ideas, his agenda.
Enoch Powell, of course,
was a Thatcher before he was a Thatcher. Because, of course, when he made his speech on immigration, of course, he was considered rather eccentric, because he advocated the denationalisation of the railways.
You're absolutely right. I mean, in some respects, Enoch Powell may have delayed the emergence of something like UKIP for 10 or 20 years in British politics, because a lot of the voters that are kind of UKIP leaners would have been sort of Powellite / Thatcherite Tories on these sort of social conservative, anti-immigration, authoritarian lines. And of course, Thatcher was a keen student of Powell's on the immigration issue and was willing to intervene. You know, the thing about immigration politics is you don't need to keep saying contentious things very often. You say them once and the voters who are concerned about this will hear it loud and clear. That's what happened with Thatcher with the Grenada interview in 78. So it's quite possible that because the sort of UKIP-type electorate was aligned to the Conservatives in the 1980s, that probably forestalled the emergence of something like that in politics. It collapsed the National Front and probably put that kind of radical right politics back 10 or 15 years. Now, of course, we have a socially liberal Conservative Party that recognises that appealing to that electorate in an era when one in six British voters within 10 years will be non-white does you an immense harm at the other end of the spectrum, so to speak. So they're not so willing to go in that direction as they were in the past, and that's part of what opened up space for UKIP.
Yeah.
As you said in your research, that it seems to the point that most voters for UKIP are coming from the traditional left. But everything in the media seems to be suggesting that it's going to split the right vote, and Miliband's kind of come out this week saying that Farage didn't come off very well in that LBC interview, but that he probably isn't a racist. Do you think that the Labour Party is taking the threats of their popularity very seriously, or they're still seeing it as a good way to support to split the right vote?
I think Labour are quite internally divided over this. It's certainly the case that a couple of years ago they were kind of cock-a-hoop about Farage because they thought it was simply splitting off a section of the Conservative vote and lowering the bar for them to win in a number of marginal seats. I think they now do recognise that UKIP are a problem for them too. I don't think it's an accident that in the same interview that Ed Miliband was distancing himself from the claim that Farage is a racist, he also announced a very large increase in the minimum wage as a Labour policy. All of a sudden you're getting this combination of, we understand where UKIP voters are coming from on immigration, we're not going to be rude about Mr Farage, and here's some traditional left-wing policies as well. That suggests to me a shift at the top towards thinking, actually, you know, the Conservatives are losing these voters, but we're not picking them up, and they should be voters we could pick up. And, you know, 40% is a lot better than 35%, and when you're not even sure that you can get 35%, well, you better try and win some of these voters back.
But it's noticeable that first the thing is Eric Pickles, then Nick Clegg, and as you said, Ed Miliband. I mean, all the parties are now taking great pains to announce publicly they don't think UKIP are racists. Now, it looks as if they've all seen the same piece of research. I mean, this summer, well, maybe your book, I'm saying, but they've all reacted almost within a very small period of time to make that point. Why do you think they've suddenly decided they need to go public with that idea in all of them?
I think it's two things.
Passing the idea that they're all in one, if you're a UKIP voter, that they're all the same, by the way. So why have they all gone with that same mindset?
I think it's two things. I think one is that they have seen a good deal of polling that shows that, well, A, the average UKIP voter, while they're very, very strongly anti-immigration, they generally aren't racist using the kind of traditional measures of racism. It's different to the BNP in that respect.
Yeah, I get the fact that the voters aren't. What interests me is the fact that the three political parties feel the need to say it. I'm not judging UKIP voters.
But that's the second thing is they've all recognised, I think, that basically attacking UKIP as a racist movement or trying to sort of delegitimate them just backfires, because the voters who are interested in UKIP as an option are voters who deeply distrust the main parties and are very dissatisfied with them. So any sort of effort to kind of pile on to UKIP is basically perceived as an effort to shut down a party that they trust by these voters and being made by parties that they don't trust. So they realise that they're not credible critics of UKIP in this respect, with the voters who they actually want to win over.
Yeah.
Yes, you said that lots of UKIP voters are generally older voters, and you say this isn't a party that's going to go away anytime soon. Well, I mean, isn't there a sort of logic that those voters will, to put it bluntly, will start dying off? I mean, is there any evidence that young voters who are, I don't know, in their 40s and 50s, you know, when they get a bit older, they become UKIP voters, so it sort of replenishes itself, or is this a sort of one generational movement, as it were?
That's a very good question. One Labour activist I talked to this about basically said, well, we don't need to worry about UKIP, the Grim Reaper will solve the problem for us. One problem with that argument is that in this era of advanced healthcare, the average 65-year-old voter is going to be around for a while. They're not going to go away very quickly. And we should be pleased about that, although it poses political problems.
That's the party's problem, isn't it? It's the party of the NHS.
I think if you make it to 65, you can now be expected to make it to 85. And so, you know, that means probably half of the UKIP electorate at least will be with us in the 2030s or even later. So they won't go away fast. But the second point is an interesting one. Is this a cohort story or is it an ageing story? You know, do people become more like sort of Alf Garnett or Victor Meldrew as they get old, just because that's part of the ageing process, that you start to find change threatening and so on? We just don't know with UKIP because they haven't been around for long enough. But coming back to the point about power, you go look at the kind of people who were voting for power back then, and they were also older working class voters. I think that the dynamic, that the where the line is drawn changes. So in Powell's era, you could be openly racist. Powell was openly racist. You can't be like that now as a radical right, sort of reactionary conservative party. But there will always be a reactionary conservative tendency in the electorate, a tendency to think things were better when I was young and all this change that's happening threatens me. But what form that will take will change.
I mean, you put quite a strong argument for why you think the bubble isn't about to burst on UKIP, and of course you may well be right, but there's also kind of a couple of fault lines that come out from what you described. First of all, I think when you say that, you know, if a broad swathe of the British public were to settle on the view that UKIP was racist, this is a barrier to every meeting. And I think Farage understands that, hence, you know, the London rally last week, getting some black and Asian candidates around. In fact, he's trying to backtrack a bit on the LBC interview about what he said about Romanians and so on. I mean, not very plausibly to me, but still, I think he knows the danger. But secondly, you also describe a party where a large number of people are, you know, wanting redistribution of wealth, critical of the bankers, possibly nationalisation and so on, supporting essentially a Thatcherite political agenda on the front. Now, I also saw polls that most people are very unaware of what UKIP's economic policies, and Farage keeps saying, you know, he scrapped the 2010 manifesto and he kind of keeps it as a bit of an empty vessel. But there is a potential tension there between the Thatcherite agenda and the people around Farage and the support they're attracting. So there are fault lines that at some point could become a huge problem for UKIP. I just wanted to say a bit more about that.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And indeed, the gap between UKIP's activists and its voters is possibly, after the electoral system, the biggest challenge that the party faces. And you see that in two ways. The first is that it's clear that UKIP does attract, you know, what our Prime Minister would refer to as fruitcakes. There is a fringe element of sort of outriders with very outlandish views that pose the party issues, because they're views that really aren't acceptable in modern society. As the only radical right party on the agenda, they are going to pick up the racist vote. That doesn't make them a racist party, but that's where the racist vote is going to go. It hasn't got anywhere else to go. So that's one problem they face, is that they'll attract that vote, but they need to both bank that vote and avoid becoming identified with that vote. And the second problem, as you rightly say, is that if you look at their senior activists, and even more so their funders, these are arch-Thatcherites. Flat taxes, deregulation, you know, privatise the NHS, the whole shebang. And Farage and some of the people who've recognised the nature of the electorate they're appealing to keep trying to keep that stuff as watered down as possible. But, you know, if you're a political activist, you're a true believer, and you want to talk about what you think about politics all the time, so it becomes very hard to keep everybody on message on that. And I actually think that the divide over economic issues could pose the party a great deal more problems than the divide over identity issues. Because the average working class UKIP voter is broadly in their camp on the identity issues. Not as extreme, but in the same zone, as it were. They are anxious about these things. They are not in the same zone at all over economic issues. And if you go and campaign on the streets of Manchester or Liverpool and the estates in those areas, and people realise that you're basically a Thatcherite true believer, that's bad news for you, electorally. But the average voter does not know that. And so I think some of Labour's campaign material that has focused on the economic story with UKIP is potentially more of a potent counter-argument than the immigration stuff.
When it's built on that, actually, like, it seems from what you say in terms of the sort of the support coming from the white working class that the sort of the old Labour support, it seems like there's a sort of almost a fight against the sort of the neoliberalism that basically won with, you know, the conversion of New Labour to, you know, a more or less sort of Thatcherite thing, and using then the economics as the potential to divide the party. If taking from that, would you say that if you could marry the sort of the oldish labourish economics and some sort of national identity, pride, concern for immigration, is that a way to bring old former Labour supporters back into the fold from their new UKIP sort of position?
Yeah, Blue Labour, exactly. Yeah. I mean, I remember when Glassman et al. Launched the Blue Labour thing, I was very sceptical about this, but studying UKIP has really changed my view on it. That is an offer that these voters want to see from Labour, but haven't believed Labour are providing for the best part of 20 years. they don't like the social liberalism of the modern Labour Party, and they no longer believe that the modern Labour Party sincerely and consistently stands up for the little guy or for the poor or anything like that. And because the distrust of Labour is very much in particular rooted to this emphasis on social liberalism over economic left-wing ideas, there is a need to marry up the economic left-wing agenda with some sort of message that rebuilds trust over these cultural social issues as well. I think that basic insight from the Blue Labour people was correct. Because the trust has been lost, you've got to work hard to win it back. So just the economic message alone probably won't do it.
Just want to say, we had an event here recently with John Denham was one of the speakers, and he said that when he sort of started getting involved with Labour, you had bus drivers and working class people who were set out to better themselves through the Labour Party. And now you've got ever so nice, progressive middle class people who are trying to better the lives of other people. And it seems like it's not so much a grassroots movement as a sort of a top down, for the good of our heart, I'm going to, try and improve.
Exactly right. And there's a good friend of mine who runs a small think tank up in Manchester called the Social Action Research Foundation. One of the only think tanks not in London, incidentally. That tells its own story, doesn't it? And he did a recent report on white working class voters in Manchester. And he found consistently the same message, that they were Labour at heart, that their roots were Labour, they remembered the Labour Party of old, they were still sympathetic to it, but they felt that the Labour Party had been hijacked by a group that they called the do-gooders, which is people who were not from round here, who didn't think like us, who didn't understand our everyday concerns, and they would refer to it in this first person plural. It was a very strong localised identity, and they'd say, who are these people to come in and tell us what to do? Who are these people looking down up their noses at us and our concerns? We can't stand it. And it was very visceral, and it meant that they would completely switch off from any message that was coming from Labour if they associated it with that do-gooder element that they felt had hijacked their party.
Like with Blue Labour, that was the most classical, man.
Indeed, absolutely. Okay, then one at the back and then in
here. Hello, yes, can you hear me?
Yes.
Right, thanks for your speech tonight. Unfortunately, I wasn't here, which was a bit of an incident at home. I wasn't hijacked by a member of UKIP, really, by that. I haven't heard most of what you said, unfortunately, but just a few observations. Now, when I came tonight, it was advertised as the biggest party to challenge the mainstream since the 1930s. I don't remember who did this in the 1930s, not that I was around, but I don't remember from the history books. And two, there's a sense of crisis there that we're going back to the times of the 30s with UKIP. Now, I haven't really got that here. Having come here, it's all fairly laid back, and don't really see UKIP as that much of a problem. Now, as for other parties opposing UKIP, now, you said, this is what I find, that UKIP is associated with being opposed to the European Union. What else? I don't really know. I'm very unclear what else they're doing. And people on the television have said this, that there's a constituency for UKIP because they don't really believe in anything else other than leaving the European Union. People don't have a lot of things to vote for them against. People who don't like other parties will go to them. Now, you identified tonight, just at the end there, some ways in which UKIP was similar to other radical right parties, such as the National Front in France and various other European far-right parties. Certainly, and that's precisely what I find, that there's a lot in common with the Thatcher government and the Conservative Party from the 1980s. Now, the Labour Party will say, well, they're not racist, but as you say, well, if they were racist, then people would support, people with that sort of tendency would support the UKIP even further. But what they've got to do is to identify ways in which UKIP are like Mrs. Thatcher, are like these other far-right parties, and fail that sort of thing. I never feel they do that. So that's one thing. Now, two. Another thing, you mentioned that Nigel Farage had been on Question Time more often than anybody. I don't really know, but I've just noticed how many times he is on Question Time, and they seem to be getting the Oxford publicity, immensely from the BBC. Now, where are the media on this? What's your sort of view of this?
Okay,
so
I'll leave it at that.
All right,
that'd be very helpful.
Okay. Thank you. On the first point, I didn't write the promotional material for this. I think what I probably would have said is the 1920s rather than the 1930s. The point is that it's the first new party to break into the system with that sort of level of support since Labour emerged, really, so you could go back even further. I don't think this is a story of a 1930s-style crisis. I do think it's the story of a deep-seated division in British society coming into politics, like the other sort of far-right parties. And I think that in terms of responding to UKIP, responding on those grounds probably won't be effective, whereas responding on the economic issues where they are more Thatcher than Thatcher would be more effective. In terms of the media's role, I'm always a little bit sceptical of how big a role the media play in these things. I do think that the attention Farage has got from the media has certainly assisted the party in certain respects. But I think the media started paying attention because UKIP grew so fast, and so this became a story. I don't think that the media attention has been entirely uncritical, and indeed in the past few weeks we've seen The Sun declaring Mr Farage to be a racist, we've seen London's or leading Britain's conversation radio doing a very, very tough interview. Has the BBC been softer than that sometimes? Yes, I think so. I dare say their approach will change now that those others have adopted that view. But so far, there's no evidence that it dents UKIP's support at all. And indeed, even if the media were to adopt a more critical stance, or the BBC were to adopt a more critical stance, you are still going to see the Daily Mail running stories every single week talking about the ills of immigration. It was very interesting to see Trevor Kavanagh describing Mr Farage as vile, given that I remember writing a blog criticising Trevor Kavanagh for mobilising Islamophobia 2 years ago when he wrote a piece about how the evil gypsy women of Romania were selling their children in order to receive benefits. Now apparently he can say that in The Sun and it's not racist at all. Mr Farage says something which is a great deal less offensive, and Trevor Kavanagh in his infinite wisdom declares it to be unacceptable. The sections of the media that mobilise this kind of thing are not going anywhere. So the extent that there's going to be a media effect, I don't think it matters what stance the BBC adopts on this.
Don't you think the media it looks to me as if the media, who are always looking for a good new story, note that UKIP spooks the other parties and just find that interesting. It's that, I think it's that simple, is it not? He so spooks them, they don't know what to do about it. It's too interesting not to follow.
Well, I have what I call the toddler's playroom theory of the media agenda, which is if you go into my son's sort of 16, 17 months old, if you go into the playroom with a shiny thing and roll it across the room, all of the toddlers in the room will chase after it in a big pack. The media behave very much like that quite often. UKIP are a shiny new thing, they're all very excited about it, so they all chase after it as a pack. In and of itself, it's a shiny new thing, but also the other shiny new element is, look at this, this seems to be getting inconsistent and strange reactions from the main parties. Let's keep lobbing it at them and see what they do. Yes.
Well, I've got two much more fundamental questions, which you obviously haven't asked yourself. Throughout your talk, you kept making assertion that this is a democratic system in this country. You said it so often, it seems you're almost trying to convince yourself, and you don't really believe it. Those of us who assiduously frequent the panels of Westminster and know politicians are perfectly well aware that this is an authoritarian system. And Boris Johnson said quite openly a year ago it's a neo-Soviet system, which of course it is. And so that rouses the question that most of the Soviet systems in Eastern Europe collapsed between 1988. And 1990. Now, do you think that can happen in Western Europe? And if not, why not? That's just the beginning, because we do have a long and bloody revolutionary tradition here in England, from Henry Wood the Wake right down through the Glorious Revolution 1688, through Magna. Tony Benn used to like saying that all our alleged freedoms have been attained by violence. And we did have rioting in Brixton and Tottenham in August 2011. Metropolitan police were driven off the streets of London by force, not for the first time. It reminded me of the Gordon riots in 1780. If black people can do that, mixed race people, Asian people are letting off bombs in tube trains because they want to impose Sharia law, which has many advantages, and white people are equally disaffected. So the first question is, since the system is so anti-democratic, why can't you have a complete collapse? Even if it were democratic, like classical Greece, you should know that Athens and Corinth often went to war. Of course, Abraham Lincoln's America was quite democratic, and that caused a bitter civil war in which more than 500,000 killed. Second problem, why do you think racism is wrong? Now, the most successful political systems in the world at the present time are overtly racist. China, for example. The Chinese Communist Party is the biggest political party the world has ever known. The Chinese economy is easily the biggest economy the world has ever known, much bigger than the United States. And it's overtly Chinese racist, 96% population, Han Chinese. Singapore, the same. It's overtly pro-Chinese racist. South Africa, which is the most successful economy in Africa, Jacob Zuma is running an overtly anti-white racist government. Well, what's wrong with that? So what's wrong with racism? It works for other people. Why can't it work for us? And why do you keep saying we have a democracy here when it's perfectly obvious we don't? And how do you think the regime will keep itself in power? Only through the secret police, through MI5 and through special
grounds? Okay, well, on the first question, I mean, I'm not a political theorist, so I won't attempt to offer a rigorous definition of democracy, but I am married to a Polish woman whose parents were in the Polish underground and were regularly arrested by the Polish secret police. And I put it to you that if you were to contend to them that this country is not democratic, they would struggle to keep a straight face. Because
people have been arrested by the secret police in this country. I am only offering you
my personal experience on this. My wife's earliest childhood memories are regularly being carted around the gardens of the blocks of flats where she lived because the secret police in Poland were turning over her apartment. Now, if this is not a democratic system, why do the people of Poland seem so eager to join the institutions which you believe are not democratic? I don't think that your definition of democracy is one that would hold much water with them. As regards the question of racism, I think that's an example of mistaking correlation for causation. China is rich, China is racist, doesn't mean racism makes you rich. The Deep South of America is very racist and is not very rich. There are plenty of other examples.
Okay, very good. Now, one final point. Two final. Erica, at the back there. Two excellent. One at the back. Very good.
Thanks for your talk. I'd just like to ask about whether the sort of lack of the sort of dissatisfaction that Labour, sort of traditional Labour voters are feeling, is anything to do with the lack of ability to protest and sort of the reigning, the sort of massive police force, and we can see sort of protests just sort of they don't happen as often, like with the mining strikes and things like that. So there's not really a culture of protesting, and therefore there's a less of event for this anxiety and sort of dissatisfaction. Thanks.
Well, on the whole, if you ask these voters what they think about the police breaking up protesters in London, for example, and so on, they tend to approve of it, UKIP voters. They tend to be very authoritarian on the whole. So I do think there is a point that they don't see any legitimate outlets for their protest. And very often younger voters who are dissatisfied with the political system do regard direct forms of protest as a way of making their voice heard, and these voters don't. So in that sense, I think you're right. However, I don't think it's that they feel that they can't protest, it's just that they don't actually regard that as the mechanism through which they want their views to become known.
And so we've talked a lot about how UKIP impacts on Labour and Conservatives and the main political parties. I'm just interested, do you think that the rise of UKIP will be the definite end of the BNP and kind of the real radical right parties in the UK? Because I know that the deputy of BNP just had to be his own political party for Britain First, and that's been getting quite a lot of media attention as well. So, yeah, do you think radical UKIP is the end to anything right in the UKIP?
It's hard to know for sure. Because of course if UKIP were to break up, which is quite possible, then more sort of far right kind of politics could re-emerge. However, the demographic trends, which as has been pointed out don't help UKIP, are even more strongly against the BNP, because the kind of out and out racism and ethnic nationalism that one associates with a party like the BNP is in very steep generational decline. So with each passing decade, that kind of politics becomes less and less viable in Britain. Indeed, one of the reasons that you see something like UKIP rather than something like the BNP is because you just couldn't be electorally viable in Britain with that kind of politics. You have to move in a more moderate direction. The kind of rhetoric that we see in the FN in France or the Wilders Party in Holland, which is not as openly racist as the BNP, but is more openly Islamophobic, even that is no longer acceptable in Britain. The long run trend, the generational trend, is very clearly away from that kind of politics.
Do you think that, you mentioned the remark that Nigel Farage made on LBC last week about Romanians, and he unusually, by the standards of party leaders, made an immediate apology. And it's easy to imagine, given how all, I mean, you get a sense among the major, the older political parties, of sort of disbelief that the many problems that beset UKIP, and it makes no difference to these poll ratings. And do you think that UKIP are in the perhaps temporarily lucky position that their mistakes are seen as evidence of authenticity? That is, that the electorate just sees them as a result of some of these mistakes, or apologising, as being, well, it's sort of real, which they don't think the other parties are, perhaps.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Farage's apology is very interesting, because it points to this sort of interesting dual dynamic that UKIP have over the next year. Their sort of core vote, these groups that have shown UKIP support, I really think that, with them, this kind of mistakes, this kind of criticism reinforces their loyalty to UKIP because of the authenticity element. This is unvarnished, this is people speaking their minds and so on and so forth. Even the Godfrey Bloom thing, most UKIP voters, they didn't necessarily agree with what he said, but they agreed with his right to say it. That's how they tend to put it. You know, yeah, he's sort of clunky with his language and so on, but why can't people be clunky with their language anymore? However, to win seats at Westminster, they know they have to appeal to voters who aren't necessarily sold on that kind of UKIP as a sort of everyday man politics. And that's why you see these regular backtrackings. The Farage is sort of walking through a minefield, as it were, and every so often something blows up unexpectedly. He's not quite sure exactly where the line is. And so when he hits it, he has to withdraw very fast because women voters, somewhat younger voters, we're not going to win the large sections of the young, but the middle-aged, you know, voters with middling levels of education, those groups he needs to expand to a local winning coalition, he needs to be more sensitive with those kind of voters. So that's why I think he backtracks, not because he's worried about losing support from the core groups, but because 30-35% demands a more moderate image.
One new question for anybody. Well, I'll come to you, Martin, don't you? Anybody who hasn't asked anything, who would like to say something? I'd like to get somebody in who hasn't asked a question.
You mentioned Monty Python earlier, of course. The idea of the Judean People's Front and Mike O'Brien is, of course, a kind of satire on left-wing political movements that were splitting. Do you think... a lot of voters tend to vote in UKIP because although they are quite left-wing themselves, they agree with UKIP on maybe a few issues, and UKIP is not united on issue. They're a big party, and they're not so they're not so sort of disfigured as so many kind of left-wing sort of people on far left parties are. And do you think there will ever be a kind of very left-wing party that is also anti-EU? Come about in the future, which probably many who vote UKIP at the moment will turn to?
Well, it's a very interesting question. Like, what would happen if there was a sort of radical left version of UKIP, you know, combining the criticism of the EU, possibly some elements of nationalism, but a radical left economic agenda? Quite possibly such a party could do very well. There have been radical left parties elsewhere in Europe with a similar mix of such concerns. The Grillo movement in Italy is kind of close to that, some elements of Syriza as well. So, you know, you may be right that a lot of these voters are not so much rightist, and maybe if there was a left party that could keep itself united, that would work as well. But the left, even more than the radical right, seems to struggle with actually maintaining any degree of unity. I guess one reason for that is because radical right activists tend to have a sort of authoritarian streak where they accept a certain degree of follow the leader, whereas radical leftists, it can be really like herding cats. They're not interested in following anybody at all. Although even in UKIP, if you look at the ballot paper for this year's European Parliament, the very first name on it will be for an independence party, which is a party founded by a disgruntled UKIP MEP who got kicked out and is now doing his best to sabotage his former party's prospects. So even there, you do see that kind of thing happening.
Actually, there have always been fairly, and Tony Benn was mentioned earlier, there's always been a fairly strong anti-EU left of centre view, and I think there's a party standing in the election, I should know this, isn't there, which I think Bob Crowe used to be.
No to EU, yes for jobs.
So it's a distinctly well to the left anti-European party. It's worth remembering the Labour Party was more, positions of the parties have changed in relation to Europe over the years. Right, one more to Martin. If anybody else wants to, who hasn't said, are you putting up a hand or are you just stretching your hand? Sorry. Okay.
I just want to talk about non-voters and to sort of explore that, because we've talked about like Labour voters who've gone UKIP, Tory voters who've gone UKIP, Lib Dem voters who've just disappeared. But I mean, Mr Farage himself is is very keen to trumpet like UKIP as a party that pick up disaffected, none of the above non-voters at all, and sees them as like re-engaging people who've had, as you talked about, no voice in politics at all. So, I mean, how much is that true, and can they keep them engaged, or is this just going to be another sort of flash in the pan that will disappoint them again?
Well, it's one of the things that's harder to pick up with the data that we have, because people who don't vote are also less likely to answer surveys, so we always tend to underestimate the number of non-voters. However, when you think about the kind of people and places that you keep doing very well with, these are the groups where turnout collapsed between 92 and 2001, Safe Labour seats where 20% or more of the electorate would disengage. If you look at Ed Miliband's seat in Doncaster North, the number of Labour voters went from 32,000 to 14,000 over the course of three election cycles. And this percentage share didn't budge, but there are more non-voters than there are Labour voters in that seat now. And I think in many cases, the path to UKIP may well pass through non-voting. You may have Labour voters who then give up, turn their backs on the party, stay home, and then come back into the arena as UKIP voters, as their loyalty to Labour has been dissolved by being out of the system. So I do think that it is an important part of the UKIP story. Whether they stay engaged, well, that's harder to know. Part of it may come down to whether or not UKIP become a viable opposition at local level in many of these seats. That may interest them. I mean, if you're a voter in Manchester Central, where I used to live, you haven't seen a viable opposition since before Churchill's prime ministership. So it may excite a lot of these voters to actually have a genuine contest in seats they've lived in their whole lives, which has not happened before. But at this stage, that's speculation. We just don't know.
Well, we'll find out, we'll begin to find out, this Thursday when the local elections, first in the first class, the post-election, an opportunity for UKIP to show how far they can go, and in parallel, they will be declared till Sunday in the European elections, and of course, with the PR, they will just inevitably do better. Just one final question. Have you had a reaction from Mr. Farage himself to your book?
He's very keen.
He's very keen.
He's said nice things about it on Twitter.
Okay.
He appeared at one of our launch events as well. So it's interesting because within UKIP, there is this, which fits with this dynamic we've seen in many of the recent debates, there is this sort of persecution complex. They expect to be attacked by everybody, in particular by left liberal academics. And so a book that basically tells the story straight was actually something they were positively surprised by. They were pre-attacking us as sort of communist Fabian lunatics before the book came out, and they all sort of calmed down a bit.
And again, this evening, an admirable exposition in a neutral way using you know, political science techniques to demonstrate how things have changed, how opinions changed. So thank you very much indeed for coming. There is an opportunity, if you should like to buy a copy of the book outside, there's a table, I'm sure Rob would sign it.
Happy to sign it.
Early Christmas present for somebody. So thank you all for coming, and I'd like to thank Rob Ford and of course Matthew Boone, who isn't here this evening, for coming and speaking.